Wondering if you should stay in Illinois or move out of state? Get your copy of Scott Tucker's book, Escape Illinois, Should I Stay or Should I Go? Get your complimentary copy at retirementdakota.com.
Investment advisory services are made available through AE Wealth Management, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
We're talking about two tragic stories that involve domestic violence, and they sort of all, both of them have a Chicago connection, and they're both unusual in that the perpetrators and the alleged perpetrators, I should say, are both professional men, one doctor and one a lawyer, although I think we all know that domestic violence knows no boundaries when it comes to these things. I want to talk a little bit about domestic violence and in particular stalking and the violence that occurs in these more affluent homes with one of the foremost experts in the field, Dr. Jenna Saul. Dr. Saul is a child and adolescent psychiatrist with over 20 years of experience working with the interaction of mental health, domestic violence, and the family court system. Dr. Saul, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for letting me be here today.
This is kind of a passion of mine, this issue. I want to just recount these stories for our listeners. This past week, there was a surgeon who was living in Chicago and working in Rockford. He was extradited to Ohio after being charged with killing his ex-wife and her new husband. There were two young children in the home who were unharmed. But what was interesting about the case was that the physician and this woman had been divorced for over 8 years, and they had only been married for a very short period of time. And the other case is a defendant who was a big firm lawyer in Chicago, and his wife was found at the bottom of the stairs of his West Loop condo, and he was charged a year later with her murder. The couple had a long history of domestic violence. So let's get to the bottom of this. Let's start first. My first question is, you see this, you see domestic violence everywhere. Is it different in affluent homes than it would be in lower income homes?
Yeah, yes and no. I mean, at its heart, domestic abuse really is about entrapping victims through manipulation, intimidation, isolation, and at least 40% of the people that experience this are not going to experience any physical abuse, and that's making it difficult to get help. But with money and status, we see the control implemented differently. So the first thing is that the tools are different. Instead of "I'll throw you out," it can be "I'll ruin you financially," "I'll take the kids," "I'm going to ruin your reputation." And second, image management becomes important. So people who are abusive and have high status are really skilled at appearing charming, generous, and put together to the outside world. So even courts and other professionals won't recognize what's going on. And the third is that the isolation looks different. You've got isolation through lavish homes, private schools, professional circles that make it harder for victims to be believed. And for the victims, they may not want to disclose the abuse due to fears of not being believed, fears of damaging their career, their partner's career, or how it'll affect their financial security or their children's schooling and lifestyle.
And that makes sense. It's the same problem, kind of on a different level. Obviously you can't diagnose or talk about these cases specifically because you're not involved with them. But this one that I find really interesting is the case of this doctor who was married to this woman for a short period of time, 7 months, 8 years. They've been divorced. The allegations are that he got in his car, drove all the way to Columbus, Ohio, and murdered his ex-wife and her new husband in cold blood. If these were the facts, and we are going to speculate, because that's all we're going to do here. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What is the motivation? And I've heard, people in the pundits talking, saying what could possibly have triggered a man to do this, given the time that came between their relationship and the act.
Yeah. So again, speaking generally and not about this case specifically, when we see a situation where an ex that has no ongoing ties at all, no children, they just show up and engage in this kind of behavior. This is about extreme entitlement and grievances. So the message is, you don't get to move on from me. I'm going to decide how this story ends. And it's not about love. It's about ownership. And it's about experiencing some kind of humiliation as a result of the breakup. Or there can be other triggers. If there's a new relationship, a remarriage, a perceived slight on social media, or some kind of interpersonal financial legal setbacks that somehow gets transposed upon that old relationship.
Very, very interesting. I had a case where a woman was divorced, and it was years. I want to say it was 10 years. She came in from the garage, and she was walking through her yard, and her ex-husband, who had been sitting in, you know, the yard for hours, drinking a whole fifth of bourbon or whatever, came and almost chopped her head off. I mean, she came within inches of dying, and the fact that her adult son was with her saved her life. But, you know, it was completely unexpected. She hadn't heard from him for 10 years. She had nothing to do with him for 10 years, not even children. And, you know, it seemed to me from all the psych reports that that's exactly what happened. He lost his job. He lost a relationship. He started feeling like she was at fault for all of the losses that he sustained, and he was going to take her out, maybe himself out at the same time. But that's why this whole thing is just very frightening for women who have been subjected to domestic violence and these issues. But you know, Dr. Saul, let's give out your contact information. Dr. Saul offices in Kenosha, Wisconsin. We're going to take a break, but I want everyone to know where they can reach you.
So I can be reached at childsbestinterest.net, and I can be reached at area code 920-379-7422.
We're talking about some disturbing domestic violence issues that we have seen in the paper just recently. Patrick, I know you had a follow-up question with Dr. Saul about the story of the physician who is alleged to have traveled to Ohio to murder his ex-wife.
Yeah, so Dr. Saul, we don't know, at least I don't know, what could have been the trigger, but a couple of questions. Is there a point in time where the person who allegedly did this act is maybe no longer a threat? Does it change over time? That's number one. Number two, from the woman's perspective, what is it that she may notice or may see that would have provided her some sort of knowledge that this guy is still a threat to her? Because if it's nothing, that's very disconcerting. But if it's something, I think a lot of people would like to know what they should be looking out for.
That's a really good set of questions, and it's there's not a lot of easy answers. The general characteristics that we know pose risk are things that are fairly static and don't change. So once someone has been a victim of someone who is coercively controlling, that risk really persists. Now, theoretically, the risk will decrease over time if there's no ongoing connection. But you remain an insult. You remain an offense for ever leaving if you've chosen to leave. And so leaving increases your risk immediately upon departure, but that risk, because you chose to end things, means that there's always some danger there. So there are common patterns that abusers exhibit, including feeling entitled. So there's possession, there's ownership, there's justification in controlling what the other party, the targeted individual, does, and that perpetrator's needs and wants will always come first for them. And with that not changing afterward, it just continues to create risk. Within that, you also have the jealousy and the possession. So during these coercively controlling relationships, any independence is disloyalty. And there's a mandate that someone constantly proves their undying commitment and devotion. So it can be really difficult to know, when does my risk decrease or end? And it's likely that it doesn't.
Yeah, especially since everyone knows if the person's being stalked, that's pretty obvious. But it seems like a lot of circumstances, maybe most, are like this, where maybe the woman had no contact with this, with her ex-husband, and had no idea that he posed a threat when clearly he did. So, I mean, that's particularly scary.
It really, really is. And that's why this case really, to me, really haunted me. But let's go back to red flags here. And we see a lot of this on the internet. But Dr. Saul, you practice in this area. What are the red flags? You know, this goes both ways for men and women. I'm not saying that all the men are the only ones who perpetrate domestic violence, so please don't send me a nasty gram telling me that I'm picking on one gender. I'm just using it for purposes of conversation. So what, you know, you're in a dating relationship, you're maybe getting back in the saddle, you meet somebody, what are the red flags that this could be going in a bad direction?
Yeah, well, I want to pick up on the gender issue. I mean, when we talk about domestic abuse, we typically are talking in a gendered way, and that is because the majority of coercive control of domestic abuse takes place with men perpetrating toward women. So when we talk about it, we tend to use those gendered terms. But as you mentioned, there's, of course, exceptions. The red flags are really, really difficult because abusers are masters at disguise. They know how to shapeshift and change and present themselves as that person that you want to be. When I work with survivors, I often will help them escape the guilt of not figuring it out sooner, reminding them that in order to have a healthy relationship, you have to present yourself in an authentic way to the person you want to be in a relationship with. And you have to also trust that they are doing the same thing. So the very first thing going on is that if you are capable of healthy attachments because you trust others, that alone creates a risk for you to be vulnerable to someone who could be abusive. So what are the red flags then? It can be things like the speed and intensity with which the relationship builds. Love bombing, quick talk of moving in to a deeper relationship. And I ask people to kind of check their own stuff. Do you feel anxious when you're away from them? Is there something that feels like some sort of magical bond and you're anxious if you're not around them and not in contact with them? That could be a warning. But the other things that happen early on are control disguised as care. So demanding access to things like your passwords or your phone and framing it as I'm protective, driving you to and from work, I'm loving, right? When really it's about control. And then as things progress, there may be more isolation, criticism and concerns expressed about friends and family, making you feel like you can't be away, creating drama around your need for healthier boundaries. And then it can escalate with you noticing that your behavior is changing because you're trying to avoid conflict. You're walking on eggshells, and that's kind of the entrapment getting more confining and constraining.
And so we just have a few minutes, and this is a fabulous topic that we need to devote some more time to. But if you know somebody who's in a relationship that you suspect might be abusive, what are the bullet points quickly of what you should do and what you shouldn't do?
Absolutely. I mean, first of all, it's so important to be their lifeline. You know, victims often don't realize that they're going through something. So if you are noticing changes to someone who's in a new relationship, it is important to try to reach out to them safely. So that's one thing is, you know, observing things. I've noticed you've seemed different lately. Do you want to talk? Is everything okay? But you could be their lifeline. So you've got to reach out compassionately. So, it's important to believe them and stay calm. It is important to name the behavior so that that sounds controlling. That sounds scary. Instead of debating what the reality is and really focusing on safety. So being cognizant of whether they are being stalked and monitored and what communications you can safely have, and offer real helps in terms of resources and safety. I mean, then also respecting their pace. It can be terrifying to leave. It's a dangerous thing to leave. There's a lot of factors that go into entrapment. And sometimes the disclosures are not occurring because of shame for not leaving and fear of abandonment for not leaving. And yet leaving is so scary and dangerous that you've got to respect that pace.
And we have really just a short amount of time, but I do want to give out some information about, there's so many resources. The Illinois Domestic Violence Hotline, I can post it on the WGN website. And Dr. Saul, can you give out your website again?
Yes. My work focuses on the child's best interest. So my website is childsbestinterest.net.